Now, exciting, the Sefer HaChinuch is going to tell us exactly how to do the malicha, which, as we discussed last time, is the only way that the meat can exude its blood that is trapped inside the meat. And we pointed out that it seems that eating this blood on its own is an Isser D'Oraisa, but perhaps once it's left the being inside the meat, once it's, while it's still inside the meat, it's considered like part of the meat, but once it has an identity unto its own, then it is a problem. So when you cook it and the juices flow around of the dish that you're cooking with the meat, so it's going to exude this blood and that's going to become usser. The only mitigating factor of whether this is an Isser D'Oraisa or Isser D'Rabbanan is maybe the prohibition of blood that has been cooked or heavily salted is only a prohibition D'Rabbanan to begin with, but nevertheless, the sages instituted that we had to just to make a general trying to keep us far away from the prohibition of blood. They instituted that we have to salt all meat to remove the blood-like juices from the meat before cooking it in a dish. So that's what we said, that if once you finish the salting process, this is what Chazal determined, that this is what's called blood, and it's going to exude a certain amount of red stuff. Right, and afterward it's juice, right. Even though it still looks a little reddish, so it's considered to be. This is the halacha that they instituted for us, that it's once it's finished the appropriate amount of time soaking in the malicha, soaking in the salt, then it's okay. So the seder malicha kachi. So what are you supposed to do? Madiach habasar yafe midam shalav. So you can't start salting the meat to remove the blood from inside the meat while there is perhaps congealed, dried, or even wet blood on the surface that's going to prevent the salt from sucking out the blood from the meat. It's just going to get absorbed in the stuff on top, so that's no good. So you have to, what part of the intrinsic halachos of the meat salting process is that you have to wash off the meat first. And our minhag nowadays, actually, is to soak it. It doesn't suffice just to rinse it off, but we actually soak the meat in a bath of water. Again, not hot water, because you can't cook the meat before the salting process, otherwise it doesn't work, obviously. And we soak it in a bath for half an hour. But in an emergency situation, if you can't soak it in a bath for half an hour for some reason, so it is sufficient simply to rinse the meat off, even according to our minhag nowadays. It's only lechatchila that we have it soaking for half an hour. Again, just to make it, I guess the chumrah is designed so that the meat becomes even softer and more easy to exude the blood that's absorbed within it. You're allowed to salt whatever size piece of meat you want. If you want to salt the entire bird, let's say you have a chicken and you want to salt the entire bird at once, that's completely fine. But if you want to cut it into pieces, then cut it into pieces before salting, then you have to salt each piece individually, obviously. You can't just put them together. That's what we, last time, so we discussed how that's a subject to a machlokes. The majority opinion is, even if you soak and salt a gigantic piece of meat, it's going to draw out all the blood, even from way inside the meat. Because he said that even let's say you salt a huge piece of meat and you cut it open, you taste that, the inside part of the meat, so it's going to taste a little salty. So you see that the salt has power over the entire gigantic piece of meat, even though you think that maybe what? But we said there's a minority opinion that actually holds that is true, that the salt only removes the blood from the outer surface of the piece of meat, so no matter how big it is. So once you cut, even after salting, if you cut the meat in two, or however many pieces, you have to re-salt the surfaces that have been cut. So that is a minority opinion, but we don't pass like that. We pass like the opinion that once you salt something, no matter how big the piece of meat is, that's it. It's completely kosher. No problem once you do that. Also, by the way, there is an opinion of the Gaonim, the post-Talmudic authorities, which is not mentioned anywhere in Chazal, that the meat cannot sit around for more than 72 hours after being slaughtered before being soaked and salted. However, if you soak it within the 72 hours, then the 72 hours restarts.
Which is the problem with meat coming from the Midwest? Is
that right? So if meat comes from the Midwest, so they used to do is, I mean, hopefully what they used to do is they used to soak it down every couple days while it was in the truck coming from the Midwest, hose it down, and then that will restart the count of 3 days that you have until you salt it. So let's say, what happens if meat waits more than 3 days before you salt it? So then you have to broil it, because as we pointed out, so broiling in some ways is an even stronger method of removing the blood than salting. So only now, since the blood has become sort of dried out within the meat, yeah, it's hard to understand exactly what that means, but since the blood is sort of dried out within the meat, then the only way you can remove it is by the fire, by roasting over an open fire, and salting does not work anymore.
If it's frozen, does it...
Right, so frozen is a problem. Frozen meat was not really an issue in the ancient Near East when these halakos were first recorded for us, but in Europe, the European Svarim, right, how you have to make sure that the meat is completely thawed out, because if you shechted a chicken, you let it sit out for a couple hours in northern Poland in the middle of winter, so it's going to start freezing. So they said that melicha also does not work if there are ice crystals in the meat. It has to be completely thawed before the melicha starts.
Well, I thought there was an issue, in fact, in Israel, of a meat from, say, Argentina,
right,
that was frozen before, being soaked and salted, and then was shipped over frozen, and then thawed out. I mean, it's not a problem, actually?
That's correct. So that's the actually disagreement between halachic authorities as to whether freezing also restarts the count. You certainly cannot do the salting while it's frozen, but perhaps the freezing process restarts the 72 hours that you have to salt the meat. So let's say... You would now have 72... No. I mean, you have 72 hours since it was slaughtered, but the freezing process would stop the clock.
Oh, no, you can't obviously soak down a frozen piece of meat. That doesn't make any sense.
Right, so let's say it was shechted on Sunday in South America and frozen within 12 hours of slaughter, then shipped to Eretz Yisrael. So now you have another 60 hours once you defrosted in Eretz Yisrael to perform the melicha. But other authorities didn't like that. They felt that it was not proper to salt meat that waited more than 72 hours after the slaughter, even if it was frozen in the meantime. So then what would you have to do to that meat? You would have to roast it. That would be the only way that you could eat it. Right, because I that is a chumra. Yes, you're right. Definitely, according to most Rishonim, that's not an issue. And as long as you roast it, no matter how long it's
you can cook it.
You can definitely cook it afterwards. It could be there is a chumra that we have the minhag to be machmer on that. That is true. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. But let's say, obviously, if you did cook it, even if we have the minhag not to, if you did cook it after the roasting, after 72 hours, it would not be forbidden to be consumed. So after you finished hosing the meat off or soaking it for half an hour, as is their minhag nowadays, v'achar kach meniach alav melach beinoni. So the type of salt you're supposed to use for salting is, why doesn't he just say kosher salt? Everybody knows that's what you go to the store, you buy kosher salt, and that's what you use for salting. That's what you use for... It's funny because it's called kosher salt, but it means it's used for koshering meat. It doesn't mean that the salt is kosher as opposed to other salt that's not kosher. We assume, as food technology continues to progress, maybe one day salt won't be kosher. Oh, maybe somebody will find bugs in salt. I don't know. But
it'll be processed on a machine.
In the meantime, right. And so in the meantime, we assume that all salt is kosher. So, so lo ave bioser kadesha yidbak boktsa. So it shouldn't be two gigantic crystals of salt, because those don't stick on the meat and can redraw the blood out of the meat. Those simply fall off. They're not going to stick properly. Even though the meat is still a little wet from the soaking, he's still not supposed to use that. Velo dak b'yoser k'dei shelo yidbak bo yoser midai. And if it's like salt, it's so finely ground that it's like flour, it just...
Salt.
Right, it just dissolves on the surface of the meat, right. and you can't really see what it's doing, and it's no good. However, this is only a din l'chatchila. This is only what you're supposed to do, but if you use the improper size salt to do the melicha, so b'dieved, it would still be permissible to eat the meat. But again, we try to use this medium-sized salt. V'lo dak b'yoser k'dei shelo yidbak b'yoser midai v'manicha v'milcho k'dei hiloch mil. And you leave it salted the amount of time it takes to walk a mil, where there are different opinions about what that is, whether it's 18, 22 and a half, or 24 minutes. And like we said, again, we assume that even if it's a gigantic ox and you leave it in soaking, encased in the salt for for 18 or 22 and a half or 24 minutes. So that is permissible to eat. We assume that in that amount of time, which is also expressed by some people, some Rishonim, as the amount of time it takes to roast meat. So you have to salt it for the same amount of time that it takes to roast it. So that we assume that that completely removes all the blood from this hunk of meat, and that's okay. So the minhag also nowadays is not to suffice with the minimum shear of a mil for salting the meat, but we actually leave the meats in the salt for 1 hour. So it takes a long time to do malicha nowadays. So let's say you're stuck, let's say it's Friday, and you realize, oh my gosh, I forgot to have a chicken for the chicken soup. I need to take my chicken from the backyard to the shochet to shecht it, but I don't have enough time to soak it for half an hour, then salt it for an hour. It's almost Shabbos, I have to prepare the chicken soup. So in that case, we actually permit you to go according to the basic halacha, and you would only have to leave it in the salt for the amount of time that it takes to walk a mil. And again, this is also one of the reasons, since we leave it in the salt for longer, so maybe it absorbs more of the blood from the insides, which is why we pointed out last time that even people who are generally try to accommodate the opinion of the Rambam that salting is insufficient if you want to cook it in a liquid medium, and you actually have to place it immediately into boiling water after the salting, then, I mean, it doesn't have, you don't have to place it into water immediately after salting, but you have to make sure that it's the water is boiling very strongly before you put the meat in, so it blanches the meat on the outside, so no more blood comes out from the inside. We don't assume that the salt takes out all the blood from this piece of meat, so if you want to accommodate that opinion, there are some people who are lenient. Some people say that's the reason, even, that we have this minhag to salt it for an hour, and there are those who say that even those who generally try to accommodate the opinion of the Rambam are allowed to eat in a sticky situation, so they're allowed to go to someone else's house and eat meat that was salted for an hour, because perhaps even according to the Rambam, you don't need to blanch it if it was salted for a full hour and it gave off more of its blood. So this is a famous halacha having to do with malicha, that everybody, that all Jewish women used to have this set of utensils in their house, which is a drain board, a board with, or something with holes, or as I've seen people use, like a drain rack that they have for, you know, utensils after you wash them. You put them by the side of the sink, so you can use that thing as well, something that has holes that allows the blood to flow off, because otherwise you have a problem, because we have a principle in halacha that's called maliach kiroseach. When something's very heavily salted, then it's considered to be hot. Even though we know normally in kashrus that if you have two things that are not supposed to be mixed together that get mixed together, that it's often only a problem if at least one of the two things are actually hot. So if something is very heavily salted, it's considered to be hot. So even if it touches something else and they're not physically warm, still it could cause a transfer of taste from one thing to the other. So let's say this piece of meat is now sitting in this heavily salted meat extract, that's blood really, and now it's going to, even though they're both cold, since it's so heavily salted, so it's going to absorb back, since it's soaking in the solution, then it's going to absorb some of the meat back. It's also a machlokes, by the way, in terms of how heavily you have to salt the meat when you're performing the malicha. So we try to accommodate the opinion of the Rush, which is that it literally has to be salt covering every single surface of the meat. Obviously, we're not malachim, we're not angels, we can't use we don't have to go to a microscope, see if there's any part of the exposed part of the chicken that's not covered with salt. But we have to try to do the best we can to literally try to cover the entire surface of the chicken with salt so that no part is left without salt.
How's it on the inside of a chicken?
You try as best you can. You try to use
full of salt, I guess, you know.
I mean, you don't literally. No. I mean, I think they probably fill the cavity with salt, and you shake it off a little bit so that it's not mamish full, but you try to do the best you can. Again, you can't it's impossible to do, you know, take a little tweezers, tiny microscopic tweezers, and put the grain of salt at every part of the.
Some people the opportunity.
So you don't have to do that. But that actually, that's the opinion of the Rush, but the opinion of the Rashba is that you don't have to do that at all. It's not required. Again, we also point out the Rashba holds you don't have to salt the meat from both sides. You just have to salt one side of the meat, and that is sufficient, and you just have to salt it to the extent that it's inedible. But once you got salted it to the extent that it's inedible, so you don't have to make sure that every single part of the surface is covered. But again, we do I try to accommodate the opinion. Ashkenazim are more serious about trying to accommodate the opinion of the Rush that every single surface of the meat has to be covered with salt. But again, you don't have to worry about this nowadays. The slaughterhouses are doing it for you. But they also try to accommodate this opinion. Yeah, it's exactly the same. All the halakhos of dam, of blood, are exactly the same for chicken, for birds, and chayos, wild animals, and domesticated animals. It's all the same. The only thing that we saw is not a problem is fish. And locusts, should you want to eat locusts. And eggs, also, we said, midaraisa, there's not a problem, eggs either, because eggs are not really the flesh of the chicken. So lokeach habasar biyado magbiho. So once you finish salting the meat, it's been sitting in the salt for the time of a meal or longer. Umenapet samelach melav. Then you have to shake off the salt. Ve'achar kach madicho yafe b'mayim shebeklim pa'mayim shalosh o yoser ad shiusar amelach v'yisra amayim shemadiach habasar b'mzakim. You have to keep rinsing the chicken off until there's no red in the water that you're rinsing it off with anymore to make sure that all the blood infused salt is gone. Let's say you leave it on too long, so what's the problem? In other words, you might think that our minag to salt meat for an hour is really no good, because maybe, since the minimum shear is a mil, so that's what Chazal said, that's the amount of time it takes the meat to exude its blood, so then maybe it's going to reabsorb. It's going to start reabsorbing the blood that it exudes after that time. So you have to make sure to shake the wash the salt off the meat immediately after the shear, which is strange because you can get it exactly after. And first of all, the different shittas about how long a meal is. So let's say you're going even with the more stringent shita of 24 minutes. So you have to shake the salt off immediately after the 24 minutes. It's hard to understand.
Wouldn't the blood, though, heavily salted blood, be considered inedible?
Well, it would reabsorb it. It's only in the salt. Okay. It's only in the salt. So once it absorbs the blood back from the salt.
Okay, but in other words, blood which is absorbed into salt, is still obviously considered edible in the sense that it will be tamei kli if it,
Right. So let's say you didn't wash the salt off the meat. Then, if you cook that piece of meat in a chicken soup, then you need 60 times the amount of salt. Yeah, mm-hmm. You have to make sure that the salt was not right. What? It's not. That's what I say. That's why you have to put it on a draining rack.
Oh, so this is talking about someone who's not using your draining rack.
Oh, no. This thing that you should, about maybe how you shouldn't leave the blood in longer, the salt on the meat longer, is not talking about something. That's just in general, because it's the bloody salt is sitting on the meat, so maybe it's going to reabsorb the blood from the salt.
Mm. Oh, that's
fine. The whole point, but in terms of sitting in the salty, bloody juice, or blood, in this case, not the juice, okay, then that's talking about if you didn't use a proper draining rack for doing the salting. But that's why you need to have, at the very least, it could be a flat thing, but it has to be slanted so that the blood runs off as opposed to sitting in the blood. Mm-hmm. So the Sefer HaKhenot tells us that fortunately we're not worried. We can have our minag about salting meat for an hour. Levishanu olrim shabasar achar shepal adamo ha'asar polet ziro kilomer mechal abasar v'alachu sheva basar v'chozman shiflet abasar oso atzir ein betivo sheyuchal livlo adam. So the point is that even if it's not continually exuding blood that's actually forbidden, because one, that it finishes exuding the forbidden blood after 18 or 22 and a half or 24 minutes, but it continues to exude some juice, so while it's busy exuding the juice, it can't reabsorb the blood. Meat can only do one thing at a time. It can either spit out or take up or swallow, as we use in halachic terminology. That blood is very slippery, smooth, and it can only be absorbed into the meat when the meat is chilled out. Not literally cool, but when the meat is relaxing. While the meat is busy trying to exude its blood, then it cannot, it doesn't have the yishuv of hadas. The meat doesn't have the peace of mind to be able to reabsorb the blood getting rid of. So it has to be completely not getting rid of anything, has to be at a completely neutral state in order to reabsorb the blood. So how long can you, what's the maximum amount of time that you can salt the meat? The rabbi said, Shehu ad yud beis shos. It's 12 hours. So if you left it longer than 12 hours, so you're worried that maybe it's going to start reabsorbing some of the blood. You don't have to throw out the entire meat, you just have to throw out the surface of the meat. That salted meat is considered boiling, like to be at a hot temperature, even though it's not physically at a hot temperature. So let's say it's not like you literally cook the two together in a pot together with water, and we would assume that you would have to get rid of the entire piece of meat because you're going to the whole piece of meat absorb here. We assume that it's limited to the surface because the salt is really sitting only on the surface. It can't bring the forbidden substance into the meat the entire way. I guess it only works the other way, to take out, but not to bring back in. So that's similar to the case where you have, let's say, a piece of meat roasting on the fire, so it's really hot, and then you have something touch it. So it doesn't forbid the entire piece of meat that's roasting on the fire, it just forbids the outer surface. Unless there's something that's what we call something that transfers the taste throughout the whole thing. For example, something very fatty, and there are different halachos regarding exactly how much it touches and where and whatever, but either you would need kedei netila, you need to take out not just the very outer surface, the basic, but you need to dig a little bit deeper inside, or it would actually forbid the entire thing from consumption. Vim lo rotzo lekalif habasar mutar lachlo bitzli. But let's say you don't want to throw out the outer surface of this meat. Shavu bishanu omrim shein koch b'melach lotzi adam haba b'lebasar mimakom acher. So the salt can only remove the blood that is intrinsic to this piece of meat, but it cannot remove anything that's absorbed into the meat that's extrinsic, that it absorbed from another place. But koach ha'ish chazak min ha'melach lotzi, as we've seen before, that roasting meat is even better at removing the blood than salting. And again, certain things that we don't rely on salting for, such as the liver. So then the roasting does work. So here, even though it absorbed the blood, it reabsorbed the blood that was sitting on the salt, so it came back into the meat and it's absorbed in the outer surface of the meat. Still, if you roast it afterwards, then that is considered sufficient to remove the blood from the meat. So you can roast it and you can eat the whole thing, or if you want to still cook it, then you may remove the outer surface and you can still cook it. Lots of other halachos of melicha. Again, it's in the Gemara, it's funny, you think there'd be pages and pages and pages devoted to this, but there really aren't. There's not so much, especially regarding this halachic melicha. There's more space devoted to the such topics as kigon dagim ve'ofos shemelachan zeimzel. So let's say you salted fish and chicken together. So you have a problem because the fish don't have forbidden blood, and the fowl, the poultry, does have forbidden blood. So therefore, the chicken won't absorb the fish juice because it's busy exuding its blood. But the fish could absorb the chicken blood because it's being salted together with it, so that could be a problem. And if you salted fish, kosher and non-kosher fish together, so in terms of they're both exuding the same things, but it's not blood, but the liquids that are absorbed in each are both being exuded. V'chilim shel cheres o shel eitz shem lachu bahen madinam. So let's say we normally are makbid not to use the vessels that use for malicha for anything else, even though it would still be cold, and which we have a lot of stringencies in that regard. The melach atzmo shemlacho bo madino. So what can you reuse the salt that has just finished absorbing all the blood from this meat?
For another piece of meat.
Right, so we generally assume...
Certainly. salary, the word salary.
That is not, but there is a minority opinion that you may. Yes, Rube Prate Hamalicha, Mivarim Bechulin, Perakol Abasar. They're explained in the 8th paragraph of Maseches Chulin, which also discusses the laws of Basar Bechalov. Meat and milk together, Perak Hamishi, Mikrisos, Yisbar Gam Kedini Hadam. Because there's a special tractate that talks about all the mitzvos, if you violate them, you receive the penalty of kares. So eating blood is one of them. So the halachos of blood in general are mentioned, of course, in Maseches Krisos. It makes sense. V'chiluke dam anefesh v'dam ha'ivarim. And there it talks about how you're only chayiv kares if you eat the blood that's mamish, the lifeblood, like if that spurts out during the shechita, something like that. And it's only the other types of blood that are found in an animal are only subject to the penalty of malchus, regular negative commandment, so to speak. V'noheges b'chol makom v'chol zman b'zchar munikevos. It applies to males and females in all places and all times. V'over aleh v'achol kazayis dama nefesh b'mezeh chayiv kares b'shogeg mei v'chatas kvua. Of course, if you eat the blood accidentally, so you bring a chatas, because it's a connection between if on purpose kares accidentally chatas. V'imachol kazayis b'dama oivarm b'mezeh loke. So let's say your meat is salting, and there's blood that's coming out, and the first, again, of course, this would only apply to the first 18 minutes of the salting process, because that's when we assume that the blood that's coming out is the real blood, as opposed to afterwards. So then you would receive the penalty of lashes if you would just drank that plain. I mean, if it was heavily salted, okay, so it's heavily salted, so maybe that's only the Rabbanan, I take that back. But assuming somehow, so you would you got access to that blood not being heavily salted, so then you'd be chayav malchus. And according to the Rambam, the salted blood is still sederaisa, then you'd be chayav malchus for that as well. And that is the end of Parshas Tzav. And we will begin Parshas Shmini. Parshas Shmini yesh ba sheish mitzvos asei v'achas esrei mitzvos lo sasei. We have 6 positive commandments and 11 negative commandments. So mitzvah kuf mem tes, the 149th mitzvah. We're going to get a couple mitzvahs now of back to the base of Mikdash, then we're going to get back in a few mitzvahs to Kashrus. Shelo yikansu hakohanim la Mikdash megudalei seyar. So if the priests have their hair too long, they can't go into the base of Mikdash. Shelo yikansu hakohanim la Mikdash megudalei seyar kemoshiyasu ha'avelim. That it's not proper for the priests to go into the Beis HaMikdash with grown-out hair. Like, it makes them look like a mourner. Doesn't look right for the Beis HaMikdash. Mourners are not allowed to cut their hair. Kilomar shelo yigadlu sarasim. They can't grow their hair. Shenem ha-rashichem al-tifro. It says you shall not grow your hair long. V'amar hatargum lo sarabun perua. You can't grow long. Because there's a duality in terms of what the root pei resh ayin refers to when it comes to the head. It could refer to two different things. One is growing one's hair long or flowing, letting it flow loose, and one is actually uncovering the head. That's what it talks about in the Sri Deish has a tshuva about this. It's very interesting. It's not really a tshuva. It's more of a philological essay. But he talks about how the different nuances of the word pei resh ayin, maybe the basic meaning is just letting the hair go loose, and then when it says by the soto, paras rosh isha, that one of the stages of the process of dealing with a suspected adulteress, when you bring her to the base of mikdash, so you have to do this para, you have to do something to her head. So what does it mean? Does it mean you have to let her hair go, let her hair down, let it all hang out, so to speak, or does it mean you take off her sheitel at the base of Mikdash? So that's really the halacha lemaisa says you have to do both. You take, remove her head covering, and you let you undo her hair so that it doesn't look so good. Anyway, so look in that tshuva of the Sri Deish about more of the changes in meanings and interpretations of the root pei resh ayin, meaning uncover or let loose. Okay. Mm-hmm. That in the pasuk in Yechezkel says they shall not have a unkempt hair. That it says by the leper, not the really leper, but somebody afflicted with saras, that his head should be uncovered or let loose, whatever. V'amar b'sifra yigadel pera. He means he has to grow his hair long. Again, emphasizing this point that the Kohanim may not let their hair long. gadol. This is repeated by, and has an extra prohibition with a high priest. The amar esrosho lo yifra, he may not cause his hair to go loose. Ve'ulam nichbala kedei shelo nachsho ma'asha amar le'alazar v'yisamar rashichem al tifro shemitzat hameis bilvad. When Nadav and Abihu die, so their brothers, Elazar and Yisamar, God tells them, you shall not let your hair go loose. So, meaning, what does this mean? Is this God is trying to tell them an absolute prohibition that you should not let your hair go loose during the times of the, when you're in the Beis HaMikdash? Or, is God trying to tell you, no, you shouldn't, this is a specific instance that I'm telling you, even though you're Avelim, you're in mourning and you're not supposed to cut your hair, I'm telling you that you must cut your hair because of your priestly status. So, so maybe if it's not actually because you're not growing your hair long because you're in mourning, but because it's a sign of mourning, that's obviously inappropriate for the Beis HaMikdash. But if a Kohen, let's say, wants to have dreadlocks because that's the style that he wants to have, so maybe that's acceptable.
Maybe he's got bigger problems.
Okay, but if you want to have, he says, I'm a hippie Cohen. I want to have a ponytail. That's how I feel suits me. So that maybe that would be okay. So al kein nisbar b'kohen gadol shezeh bishvil ha'avodahu shitzaveu Hashem listafer. That it's not because of that. It's because of the honor of the Beis HaMikdash. It's inappropriate to have people with men with long hair at that point. Mishor she ha-mitzvah hu hagdolas habayis, that it's trying to make the Beis HaMikdash better, more beautiful, more grand. K'mo she'amarnu le'malash, and it's davinu la'agdilo b'chol kocheinu mi'enotam she'amarnu. We've always talked about, when we talked about the Beis HaMikdash, how it's important that we have the proper perspective of the Beis HaMikdash and the proper awe. V'alkein roi lanu she'lo navu sham megudali ser k'derech ha'avelim. It's just not proper to have long hair, even though we're not actually in Avelos. But it looks like we're unkempt as if we're in Avelo, so we shouldn't do it. Chinei Mashenemar b'Megillas Esther, coming up to Purim time. Ki ein lavo el Shar HaMelech b'levush sak. You can't go. It's not appropriate to go to the gateway of the king with sackcloth. You have to dress properly, and you have to have a proper grooming when you go to the palace of the king. So if that applies to Melech Achashverosh or Kal v'Chomer, so certainly it should apply to the holy Beis HaMikdash, where we go kavyachol to visit God. Kolomer, ein roi lavo el Beis Hashem rak derech sason v'simcha v'tanug. That when we go to the Beis HaMikdash, we're supposed to be happy, and it's supposed to be enjoyable and nice. Lo derech avel v'tzar. And even though you could say, I like long hair, this is how this is what works for me. We have a general principle across the board that that's not okay.
No,
that's not because of that. You're talking about Hasidim or something, that they shave their hair for other reasons.
They go to the mikveh, so they... Is that it? Or?
What do you mean? Go to the mikveh, you don't have to cut your hair before you go to the mikveh, unless you're planning to cut it soon afterwards. That's a chumrah. Yeah, we have a chumrah that if you have hair that you're thinking of soon cutting, so you're supposed to remove it before you go to the mikveh, because there is a minority opinion that even though it's attached to your body, since you basically want to get rid of it, so it would be a chassid. Men and women.
Oh.
No, both. I mean, men, it's less important, at least nowadays, unless you go to the Har HaBayis or something where you really need a kosher immersion in the mikveh. But, so that's a chumrah. Hair that you want to have there on your body, that's not a problem at all. That's, of course, that's part of your body, so for sure you can go to the mikveh with that. So, the cutting of the hair is not, and even, let's say, a woman did go to the, so this, again, this is purely chumrah. We try to do it, but let's say a woman did go to the mikveh and she realized that there were hairs on her body that she really wanted to remove, but she forgot to remove them before she went to the mikveh, so she would not need to go back to the mikveh, certainly. Because they're part of your body, according to the vast majority of opinions. Anything that's actually attached to and part of your body, even if you want to get rid of it, is not a chatzitza. No, chassidim cut their hair for other reasons, because according to Kabbalah, the hair of the head represents the Midas Hadin, represents the attribute of justice of God.
The hair?
And the hair, yeah. and the hair of the beard and peyas represents the midas harachamim. It represents the attribute of mercy of God. So you draw, you cut your hair, the hair of your head, as short as possible. And you grow, you don't touch the hair of your beard or the hair of your peyas because that represents the midas harachamim. You want to encourage, you want to show that you want God's mercy.
There's two ways to ask this. One is, where do they get
this stuff? That's the Arizal, writings of the Arizal.
Where does this come from?
From the writings of the Arizal, yeah. Anyway, okay. The Chasam, speaking of Hungarians, just while we're on the topic, so the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva. He said that...
He's a yucca.
What?
He's
well, he moved to Hungary. Okay. Oh, Hungarians are Ashkenaz also, really. Mm-hmm. The Hungarians are not... there are Hasidim from Hungary, but Hungarians originally are real Ashkenaz Jews. We were in Budapest for Shabbos, so they try as best they can. Most of the people there don't know what's going on, but they hire a chazan who knows the customs of that synagogue from before the war. Mm. And basically, it's like being at Breuer's, except they're saying "Buri chatu Hashem Elokeini." Funny, they sound like they sound like Hasidim, but they use the same tunes, the same not exact same words. That's they say the same piyutim and the same everything as words. They're real Ashkenaz Jews. They're not Hasidim at all. So the Chazanover is a tshuva. So the custom was again, as Charlie pointed out, that Hungarian women after they get married they completely shave their heads. But this was only done the morning after the wedding. This was not done at the wedding itself. So, the question is, that Chasam Sofer addresses in a tshuva, he said, wait a minute, but we try to be concerned for this opinion that hair that you're about to cut off is a chatzitza for the tefillah, so when the bride is going to the mikvah right before the wedding, how can she have her hair? Because she really wants to cut it off soon.
She also wants to get married, that's what
right. So the answer is that... the answer is that now she wants it. That since the minhag is only specifically to cut it the morning after wedding, so now so the chumrah of hair that you really want to remove, but you forgot to remove, is not hair that you really want to remove. You're supposed to take off before the mikvah is not applicable over here because even though she wants to remove it soon, she specifically only wants to remove it after the wedding. So right now, the two reasons. I mean, if you're used to it, so you get used to it. I don't know.
It's like a guy with a crew cut.
I mean, the two reasons that are given for the women, the married Hungarian women covering their... Samarov claims this was originally a much more widespread minhag, and it was only because of shmad or something that the governments insisted that Jewish women grow hair like everyone else, that they stopped doing it. Again, we know that even that minhag, even if it was more widespread, was also had limited provenance, certainly in the times of the Rishonim. You look in the Halda Halachos and the Shulchan Aruch about chatzitzas before the mikvah, of course it's all talking about hair. It's about what happened. But so, of course, Jewish women had hair. There's actually a Targum where it talks about Lo Yilbash Gever Simlas Isha. One of the Targumim, the American translation, says that a woman should not cut her hair short because it's like a man's haircut.
Yeah.
So, okay, that was... Anyway, Meseder, fine. Okay, but the reason given for the specific minhag that was recently in Europe, that certain sects married women did shave their hair, is A, that it eliminates problems of going to the mikvah, that if you have, because you're not going to have any chatzitzas in your hair, and you're not going to, let's say the mikvah lady isn't watching too closely, and you have, so you, obviously we know that when you go to the mikvah, your whole body has to be immersed at one time, and that includes your hair, which is part of your body. So that's the job of the mikvah lady, that the mikvah lady is really there to make sure that when a woman goes to the mikvah, if she has long hair, so very easily some of the hair could float to the surface. So if some of the hair can float to the surface, and if the hair is not immersed under the surface of the mikvah, it's as if the woman did not go to the mikvah at all. It's completely not an invalid immersion. So the woman, the mikvah lady, is there to make sure that all the hair goes under the surface of the water. So they want to eliminate this problem. A lot of times in the mikvahs in ancient, not ancient times, but in 100 years ago, 100, 200 years ago, a lot of times the lighting in the mikvahs might not have been so good. Maybe the mikvah lady didn't see properly. Maybe at certain, sometimes the woman had to go to the mikvah in at a time where she did not have a mikvah lady available. She had to go by herself. So if she doesn't have hair, that eliminates the need for a mikvah lady. Mm-hmm. technically, according to, I mean, mikveh ladies now have assumed other duties as well, but technically the real halachic need for mikveh lady is just so the hair should go under the water. So, and another reason is that the Hungarians, the Chasam Sofer has another tshuva where the Hungarians are based on another tshuva of Chasam Sofer, are extremely stringent that a woman should cover every single strand of hair. It's based on a Zohar. It's that they do not allow any tiniest amount of hair to show, so they feel that it'll be easier to conform to that chumrah if the woman simply shaves her head and doesn't have any hair to speak of.
Then she doesn't have to cover
her. No, you do have to
cut.
No, that's not true. Even a woman who has a completely shaved head must cover her head. It's two halachos. The hair is considered part of the head, but that's a specific halacha that you have to cover. So that is not correct.
I really wonder why people go off
the beard.
What?
Come on. What about hair of the beard?
If a woman has a beard? What do you mean? If a woman has a beard, she does not have to cover it. Yeah?
That's a mikveh. Why isn't there a chumra that he must shave his beard? Because otherwise...
The beard is on the bottom. So if your head is underwater, your beard is also going to be underwater.
Depends on how long it is.
And maybe payas are going to flow. Your hair payas are too long, they're going to float to the top. No. What do you mean? The men also have to be completely underwater. The men, we're not so makbid about chatzitzas. There are two halachos. One is that you're not allowed to have anything between your skin and the water of the mikveh, or your body in the water of the mikveh when you go to the mikveh. I mean, we'll discuss the exact details. We'll get there in a few mitzvahs from now. And another is that your entire body has to be under the surface of the water. So many times the halachos of not having anything intervene between your body and the water of the mikveh is only the rabbanan. So it's very rare that you would get a deraisa that you really have to have a pretty substantial separation for that to be the case. But that's only applies if your entire body is under the top of the surface of the water. If your entire body is under the top of the surface of the water, and let's say you have, some Play-Doh stuck to your skin or something like that. So that would be a chatzitza derabanan in the vast majority of cases, that would be only a chatzitza derabanan. On a deraisa level, you will have considered to be having gone to the mikveh. But if your entire body is not under the surface of the water, then that is an invalid tevila on a deraisa level. And then if a woman is a nida and she goes to the mikveh but fails to immerse her entire body under the water, even including the hair, then that is considered that she did not go to the mikveh at all, and it would still be a chiyuv kares to have relations with her husband, or hopefully with her husband, but anybody else as well. Okay. V'chol zeh yechazek ha'yesod ha'bonoi b'rosh ha'binyan. This is all strengthening my thesis about the purpose of all these halachos in the Beis Hamikdash. Ki kol inyani habayis v'masav l'chazek v'letzayr b'leiv ha'osim maseh ha'kosher l'archik b'libo machshevosam kol kir v'chol chet. That everything, when it comes to the Beis Hamikdash, you should have a completely rosy picture of it. Should nothing be marring your perception of the Beis Hamikdash. Alkein biyos kavanas habayis v'zeh roi lanu lavosham derech kavod v'yira gedula v'simcha. We should go there with in a happy state, in a well-kempt state. Our hearts are going to melt at the sight of this wonderful place, and we'll be more able to absorb the kedusha of the Beis Hamikdash and receive the goodness that it's going to bring to us. And that reminds me of my drasha yesterday, actually. You have to be happy in order to receive the full message of holiness. Okay. Dinei HaMitzvah. Halachos of the mitzvah, kigon mash amar zichron levracha, shisur gidul pera bekohanim hedyotim enu ela b'shas bia lamikdash. For regular kohanim, it's only while they're actually in the Beis Hamikdash that they're subject to this prohibition. While they're outside the Beis Hamikdash, they could become a nazir, no problem. You could grow your hair, you could have your dreadlocks, you could have your ponytail. Aval kozman she'in kohen hedyo nichnas lamikdash enu b'sur gidul pera klal. Aval kohen gadol lefishu tamid b'mikdash asur b'gidul pera l'olam. So the kohen gadol is considered a fixture of the Beis HaMikdash. So since the kohen gadol is a fixture of the Beis HaMikdash, he's not really supposed to leave, so he may never grow his hair long. Kilu tomar shim yelo derech ones lamel chutz lamikdash k'tzas yomim min achiyuv olav afalpikin shel yigadol pera. So even if for some reason he has to be out of the Beis HaMikdash for a little while, he still cannot grow his hair long. V'chamo gidul pera, what is considered to be long, shloshim yom kinezirus. If you don't get a haircut for 30 days,
that's what
considered to be too long.
Yeah.
What?
That's what the barbers always say.
Yeah.
Get a haircut every 30 days. You know, uh-huh. I always thought it was just self-interest. You know?
Uh-huh. No, they knew the halacha. So this is learned out from the Naziros. Shestam Naziros Eino Pochos Mishloshim Yom. So since it says that a Nazir must be Megadel Pera, the Nazir must grow his hair long as opposed to the Kohen who can't. So the Stam, the regular normatively assumed duration of a Naziros period is 30 days. So therefore, we learn out the halacha from Naziros that it's 30 days of not getting a haircut that is considered to be too long for worship in the Beis HaMikdash. It's pretty much self-understood. It's not so complicated halachas. Yeah. Benohegis b'zman abayis b'zichrei kuna applies to male priests at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. What? B'zman abayis b'zichrei kuna ve'over alev nichnas l'mikdash pera rosh. Kolomar achar shegidel saro shloshim yom ve'avad sham. So you grow your hair for 30 days and you perform the worship in the Beis HaMikdash. Chayam misa bidei shamayim. So God is going to kill you. Shenemar rashechem al tifro v'lo samusu. It says you won't die if you do this. V'divrei haTorah no trikon him. Kolomar haim yifro rashechem yamusu. Mekomakom ein avodos apsula. Even so, the punishment is purely divine. The worship, the service that the Kohen performed in the Beis HaMikdash is still valid. It's not pasul. But if you don't perform worship, then it's simply a negative commandment. If the Kohen goes into the Beis HaMikdash with long hair, then he received the penalty of lashes. But he doesn't receive the divine death penalty unless he actually performs part of the service of the Beis HaMikdash. That's how we explained the verses earlier. The Ramban, Zichron of Racha, Nachmanides disagrees with this. Kasav ki peru harosh lo yikanesh lemikdash malahu midivrayim. The going into the Beis HaMikdash per se is only the Rabbanan, just to add to the glory of the Beis HaMikdash. The lo midaraisa, it's not biblical at all. But Yosef Besifro, he talks about in his commentary to Rama Sefer Mitzvahs, Velamar shelo ba kasuv lesser ala kriva la avoda lubichal lav deval mum shabbat. It's the whole idea is really only talking about worship. Performing the service in the Beis HaMikdash, v'chasavot shav chachovim lo asrela mokom adikra benum la mizvech. And even the Rabbanan, it's only the part that's really close to the between the temple building itself and the altar, which was in the courtyard, which is forbidden. Aval keneged hamizvech atzlo shu shtayim v'shalashama, moshe shanir hamizvech shtayim v'shalashama, benum la mizvech shtayim v'esrim lo asru. But in other parts of the Beis HaMikdash, even there is not even a rabbinical prohibition, again, maybe not be appropriate, but there's no specifically formulated rabbinic prohibition per se, not to enter the Beis HaMikdash.